Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York, and co-founder of String Theory. And we're talking about his latest book, The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Professor Kaku, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on.
This is an amazing book. The breathtaking range of this book was amazing to experience, and I want to strongly recommend that people do that. I mean, you start out with, you know, bases on the moon and Mars, but you literally bring humanity, or what it evolves into, past the end of the universe, which I thought was an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, being a physicist, we have to look at the earliest ages, but also the end of times as well. We look at the whole spectrum of the age of the universe.
But not in one book? That's quite an accomplishment.
Right. Well, it's what I do for a living.
Now, I want to start out in the beginning. I'm a person who's old enough who grew up with the landings on the moon and the whole from Sputnik on and our landing on the moon. And I was one of those people who were enthused by our space program. What happened?
Well, we had that Sputnik moment, right, back in 1957 when it was your patriotic duty to become an astronomer, a physicist, a chemist, right? But then, well, the Cold War sort of wound down, and people look at the price tag, which was huge, and NASA became the agency to nowhere. It boldly went where everyone went before for 50 years. But now things are changing. Millions of people watched the launch of the Falcon Heavy rocket.
Yeah,
thousands lined up the streets of Cape Canaveral to watch that rocket. That was a moon rocket. For the first time in 50 years, a moon rocket blasted off Cape Canaveral at the very same launch site that sent our astronauts to the moon back in 1969. And it was paid for by a private individual, Elon Musk. We got it for free. If I would have told you, you know, 5-10 years ago that somebody would give us a full-fledged moon rocket for free, I would think you're nuts. But it actually happened. And it was reusable, just like in a science fiction movie. You saw those two rockets descend back to the launch pad.
It was like something out of a 1930s space movie. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, and that's how much times have changed. You know the movie The Martian starring Matt Damon? That cost $100 million. But the Indians sent a space probe to Mars for $70 million.
Wow.
You realize that a Hollywood movie about going to Mars costs more than actually going to Mars.
Now, is NASA going to still have a role?
I think so, because, first of all, we have not one, but two moon rockets capable of putting our astronauts on the moon. NASA has the SLS booster rocket, which next December, is going to carry an unmanned Orion space capsule to the moon. Not to be outdone, of course, Elon Musk of SpaceX has his own booster rocket ready to go. And beyond that, we're talking about Mars. In fact, Elon Musk has even designs for a bigger rocket, even bigger than the Falcon, called the BFR. B for big, R for rocket, and F for your imagination.
Now, how are things going to proceed in this? And I'm looking for your opinion, which is very well informed. Are we going to build a moon base first so that we can launch from there to Mars, or are we going to go directly to Mars bypassing the moon?
Oh, well, NASA laid out its plan. Its plan is that December next year, we have an unmanned rocket go around the moon, the SLS. Then in 2023, 4 years later, we're going to send astronauts to the moon. Then 2 years after that, we're going to build a lunar base, a lunar orbiter. Just like we have the International Space Station, which goes around the Earth, we're going to have a mini space station go around the moon. And then from there, we're going to create a new rocket, which will take us all the way to Mars. That's the NASA plan. Now, Elon Musk apparently wants to cut some corners. And he says, well, why not do it in one jump? So we'll wait and see how things evolve. But some kind of public-private partnership, I think, will eventually emerge out of this. Well, and who benefits? The taxpayer benefits.
That's right.
Because we're not going to be saddled with huge, huge budgets anymore. Private enterprise jumps in. And, you know, Amazon.com, They've jumped in. Jeff Bezos is the richest man on earth. He has his own private launch pad in Texas, believe it or not. And he wants to create an Amazon delivery system to the moon, so astronauts can order their books on the moon via Amazon.
Now, there's also a very real possibility that we're going to go back to sort of a competition with another country. China's planning on being on the moon, as you write in your book, by 2025.
That's right. Yeah, they've since pushed their timetable a little bit back. But yeah, China has said that first they're going to have a real space station similar to our space station in outer space, and then from there put the Chinese flag on the moon. That's why it's a new ball game, totally new ball game. Prices have dropped. We keep thinking about how expensive the Apollo space program was, which it was, but now prices have dropped to the point where India, China are major players now in this game, and we don't want to be left behind.
Now, let's talk about moon base first.
Mm-hmm.
How do you envision the first setting up of a moon base, and what are the major obstacles to doing this?
Well, you know, we have a ready-made Mars and moon base underground. There's something called lava tubes that is leftover tubes from volcanic eruptions billions of years ago. And we have pictures of them. We see the openings of these caves. And so if you saw the movie 2001, you realize that the moon base on the moon was underground. That protects you against radiation, against solar flares, against micrometeorites. And so that's the first thing they can do is to go underground. And then mining operations will start because ice is more expensive than oil in space. Oil doesn't burn in space because there's no oxygen. So oil is useless in outer space. But ice can be melted for drinking water and separated for hydrogen for rocket fuel and oxygen for breathing. And so the first things a settlement would do was to set up a base, perhaps underground, and start to mine the ice for rocket fuel.
Now, going from there to Mars seems very, very challenging for a couple of things. First of all, just the time period on getting from, say, Earth orbit or the moon to Mars, we're talking about over a year just to get there. What kinds of things are people looking forward to in the design of spacecraft that are going to accommodate what the astronauts are going to need?
Well, you're right. First of all, to go to the moon was a hop, skip, and a jump.
It's not that far.
3 days, 3 days back. 1 week, you can go to the moon and back. I think that our grandkids will honeymoon on the moon. That's right, honeymoon on the moon, because space tourism. Space tourism is a reality. Richard Branson, another billionaire, is betting on space tourism, and so is Jeff Bezos, richest man in the world. And they think that people will pay money to go to the moon as a tourist attraction, get married there, for example. Now, Mars, as you correctly pointed out, is no picnic.
We're talking
about a 7 to 9 month journey to Mars. Then you have to wait a few months for the alignment of the planets to come right, and then another 7 to 9 months journey to come back. Now, Elon Musk, in his inimitable way, has said that he can do it in just a few months.
What?
He says that a new generation of rockets, probably the plasma rocket, which is being experimented with, I think that's what he's referring to, a new kind of rocket eventually could bring down the time period to just a few months. But initially it's going to have to be done the old-fashioned way with chemical rockets, and as you pointed out, a round trip is going to be 2 years' time. And you got to be pretty sturdy. You got to be like an Air Force pilot to volunteer for the first mission, and I tell you, hundreds of people have volunteered to be the first people to go to Mars. It's amazing.
Now, one of the things you talk about in your book at end is what we've already learned about the long-term effects of humans being in either zero or low G. What are those?
Yeah, you know, the Russian astronauts have set the world's record for being in space over 1 year. And when Commander Polyakov came back from the space station, there's a videotape of him crawling out like a worm, crawling out of the space station because of so much muscle atrophy. That's the reason why our astronauts have to constantly exercise. Because without exercise, your bones and muscles get the idea that they don't have to do any work, and so they start to leach out potassium and calcium and different kinds of minerals. And so that's why we have to keep our astronauts continually exercising, or else they too will wind up like a worm when they wind up on Mars. So we know this. So we're training our astronauts to continually exercise.
Now, what about mental, just mental health? That's a long time to be cooped up in a very small space.
Yeah, that's right. That's why we're actually experimenting on the Earth with Mars capsules confining people together for long periods of time. And think about it. If your next-door neighbor in a space capsule is somebody you don't particularly care for.
Oh, my God. What a disaster.
Yeah, if they eat crackers in the middle of the night and you hate crackers. That's why they're actually going to have to pit them with each other early, beforehand on Earth, to make sure that they're compatible. So don't wind up like two old married couples yelling at each other at night.
Can you imagine that? And you still have two more years to go.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So they
get to test the compatibility ahead of time.
So they get to Mars. What's their first goal? What do they need to set up first? And again, I imagine that they're going to have to go into lava tubes like they would in the moon, because the radiation is going to be a real problem.
Yeah, well, that's where the movie The Martian really got it right. First thing you do is you unfurl solar panels, because you need power. Because going to the moon, you're going to exhaust many of your batteries. So you're going to have to unfurl solar panels to re-energize yourself. And then after that, to get a permanent base camp, either use a lava tube or use the soil of Mars. It turns out that we can reproduce the soil of Mars on the Earth, and we can make brick out of Martian soil. This has been done. And so we have a ready-made source of building materials on Mars, which is to heat up the material there and create bricks. And so we can create a Mars base on Mars. And then, as I said, mining operations to mine water for drinking purposes and rocket fuel.
Does this mean that we would probably go near the poles?
Eventually, see, the poles are kind of rocky. That's why we have landed our space probes in a very boring area of Mars, which is flat, very flat. That's why we don't see any Martians or any futuristic structures on Mars, because we landed the most boring place on Mars so that our space probes don't tip over. But eventually, astronauts are going to have to go to the ice caps, because there's plenty of ice there. Plenty of ice for rocket fuel and oxygen.
But one of the things you write about in the book is it's two very different poles.
Yeah, and we have, first of all, we have a carbon dioxide pole that oscillates, gets bigger and smaller. And we see that with telescopes, even amateurs can see that during summertime, the poles get smaller and then larger.
So it's dry. It's dry ice.
Dry ice, that's right. Solidified carbon dioxide. And then the permanent poles are made out of ice. Ordinary water ice. And so we have two kinds of poles on Mars, and eventually we want to melt them. If we can melt the polar ice caps, we can once again have rivers and oceans and seas on Mars. Mars once had an ocean the size of the United States of America. That's how big that ocean was on Mars. And we can recreate these things by solar satellites beaming sunlight down to the ice caps and melting them. Now, Elon Musk was asked about melting the ice caps, and he wants to do it in a quick and dirty way. He wants to detonate hydrogen bombs on the polar ice caps. Now, I don't think our astronauts want to drink radioactive water.
No.
So I think solar satellites is the safe way to slowly melt the ice caps for drinking water.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at City University of New York, one of the co-founders of string theory, and a great writer. And we're talking about his latest book, The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. Obviously, from writing this book, you believe that humanity's destiny is not just on Earth.
Yes, that's right. You know, the dinosaurs did not have a space program. And that's why they're not here today. There are no dinosaurs in this room to talk to because they did not have a space program to protect themselves 65 million years ago when an asteroid about 6 miles across plowed into Mexico, wiping out the dinosaurs. So we do have a space program. And realize that Mother Nature can be cruel. We think of Mother Nature as being warm and cuddly, but 99.9% of all life forms on Earth have gone extinct. If you don't believe me, simply drill right under where you're standing right now. Right now, just drill directly, and you'll see the bones. The bones of the 99.9% of life forms that have gone extinct. Now, we don't want to be part of that 99.9, but extinction is the norm. That's what biology teaches us. Extinction is the pattern. Now, to evade that fate, we're going to have an insurance policy. And that's why I think we should create a settlement on Mars. Not to evacuate the Earth. That's impossible. No one's talking about that. But a settlement, just as an insurance policy in case something bad happens to the Earth.
Is there other reasons to establish a colony on Mars? Are there sort of minerals that would be interesting? And is it worth mining, getting it all the way back to Earth?
Well, you know, we talked about how Amazon has jumped into the game. We talked about how Tesla Motors has jumped into the game. Now, Google, heavyweight, Google has jumped into the game. And they see that mining asteroids and mining the moon and Mars, that's a gold mine out there. You know, when Thomas Jefferson, 200 years ago, bought Louisiana and the Midwest from Napoleon, he thought it would take 1,000 years to develop what we call the Midwest. Well, it was done very quickly because in 1849, we discovered gold, gold in California, and millions of people converged on the West Coast. Well, gold now could be found in the asteroid belt. In fact, it was President Barack Obama himself who initiated it. It's called Asteroid Redirect. Lassoing an asteroid, bringing it back down to Earth, a small asteroid would have up to $50 billion worth of platinum metals and rare earths that are used in the electronics industry. So Google already created a company, Planetary Resources. Google billionaires said, yes, mining the asteroids could be mining the heavens.
When you write about mining the asteroids in the book, there are several challenges to asteroids. First of all, not a lot of them are spherical. They're really odd-shaped, and like so potatoes. Their movements are really bizarre.
Right.
And then we're not really sure about what the consistency of their surface is like.
Right. Now, we have gorgeous photographs.
Oh, beautiful ones.
Asteroids, right?
Yeah.
By our space pros. But you're absolutely right. They're shaped like a potato because they're small. The bigger you are, the more gravity is stronger. And when a planet is molten, it bends the planet from a potato into a perfect sphere. And that's why the sun and the Earth and all the celestial bodies are round. But asteroids are tiny. There's not enough gravity to round it out. And so also we've never actually landed on an asteroid except by space probe. What happens if the asteroid is actually a collection, a loose collection of rocks? Then as soon as you land on it, oops, the whole thing disintegrates.
Now, getting back to Mars, is there a plan or ideas about terraforming, in other words, literally transforming the planet so that it would be habitable and have an atmosphere that would be breathable?
Right. Well, first of all, we are terraforming the Earth, for words.
Right.
We are actually changing the atmosphere of the Earth. Now, we want to terraform Mars in a good way. First, you can inject some methane gas to stimulate the greenhouse effect. Satellites can begin to melt the polar ice caps. If you could raise the temperature of Mars just by 6 degrees, then the greenhouse effect goes into a runaway mode. The warmer it gets, the more carbon dioxide comes out of the rocks and things and creates even more greenhouse gases. And it is a tipping point. So 6% is the tipping point that we want to achieve with terraforming Mars. And then it terraforms itself.
And you'll be actually able to walk around without fear of radiation because the atmosphere would be thick enough?
Yeah, once you get the atmosphere to be thick enough, you can support liquid water on the surface of Mars. Right now, if you have a glass of water on Mars, it'll boil all by itself.
Wow.
The boiling point of water depends on pressure.
Right.
This Mars has a very low pressure. The boiling point is low. So a glass of water on Mars will actually boil by itself. That's what happened to the oceans of Mars. Mars once had great oceans. A Mississippi River Delta-like formation we see on the surface of Mars. So Mars once had rivers, seas, oceans, but they all kind of like boiled away. Now we can reinstate that by melting the ice caps, by heating Mars up to 6 degrees, and a runaway greenhouse will further melt the ice caps so that liquid oceans flow freely on the surface of Mars.
And as you talk about in the book, Mars is probably the only planet in our solar system that we would even think about terraforming, and it would work, because certainly Venus, the next one in, we would never be able to do anything with.
Venus used to be considered tropical. All science fiction novels have our astronauts.
And they'd have tribes of women living there, too.
Yeah, right. Zsa Gabor.
Right.
There's a movie with her. The Fire Maidens.
Queen of Outer Space.
The Queen of Zsa Gabor, right.
That's right.
Well, yes, Venus, we used to think, was tropical, but now we realize it's our evil twin.
Oh, my God.
Temperatures there are 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the melting point of lead. So if you were to walk on the surface of Venus, your feet would sink into some of the hot molten metals. Tin and lead
Wow.
are in molten form on the surface of Venus. So you can cross Venus off your bucket list.
What about some of the moons of the gas giants?
Yeah, you know, first of all, Titan, a moon of Saturn, we were shocked to find, has an atmosphere made out of methane. That's going to be the gas pump for the future.
Right,
we're going to use Titan as a refueling station. So one day, once we have rockets that can take us outside of the solar system, we'll land on the moons of Saturn, because Titan has methane, which is valuable as rocket fuel. And also Europa, a moon of Jupiter, has an ocean under the ice. The ocean has a larger volume than the oceans on the planet Earth.
Mm.
It's incredible. Who would have thought an ocean of liquid water underneath the ice cover of a moon of Jupiter? And we're going to put a submarine. NASA has plans to put a submarine under the ice to then see whether there are any sea monsters or any life underneath the ice. And so, yeah, we realize now that the moons of Jupiter and Saturn are much more interesting than Jupiter or Saturn themselves.
It's like another whole solar system that we just started to discover.
Yeah, that's right. We now realize that that Europa could be very typical throughout the universe. And so aquatic life may actually be more abundant than ordinary terrestrial life. And speaking of planets, you know, we've discovered so many thousands of extrasolar planets.
That's right.
We now realize that Earth-like planets could be a dime a dozen in the Milky Way galaxy, billions and billions of Earth-like planets in our own backyard.
But that means that we're going to have to develop better propulsion systems or better ideas of how to get to very far away places.
Right. So when you go out tonight, look at the night sky, realize that somebody could be looking back at you from outer space. And realize that, yes, we have plans to go to the stars now. Stephen Hawking, my colleague, has an idea to take chips, computer chips from Silicon Valley, attach into a parachute, and then blast away with a laser beam to inflate that parachute. And so these projectiles of chips go to 20% the speed of light. And in just 20 years, you're on the nearest star. So the first starship will not look like the Enterprise.
Wow.
The first starship will look like a postage stamp.
Now, one of the other themes in your book, which I find really fascinating, is robotics, but also the sort of interface of the human body and machinery, which also seems to benefit if we're going to travel extrasolar, extrasolar system. Maybe we won't be totally human.
That's right. I mentioned one speculative design that I came up with called laser pointing. You know, in the next few decades, we're going to digitize humans.
Right.
All your credit cards, transactions, pictures, videotapes, Instagrams, all your emails will be digitized to create a reasonable approximation of who you are. And by the end of the century, we'll even map the human brain. So all that information can be placed on a laser beam, because lasers can transport information, and we can shoot that to the moon. So in 1 second, every memory, every sensation, all your consciousness could be on the moon. On the moon, you would download it into a mainframe and then put that information into an avatar, either a hologram or a robot. And so you would actually see through the eyes of a superhuman robot on the moon. In 20 minutes, you could be on Mars. In 4 years, you could be on the nearby stars, traveling at the speed of light, the fastest velocity in the universe, without booster rockets, without weightlessness problems. And let me stick my neck out. I think that perhaps this already exists.
What?
See, I think that aliens in outer space, they're not going to use flying saucers. They're so clunky. They're so 20th century flying saucers. They're going to digitize their consciousness and shoot it through outer space. There could be a highway, a super highway of laser beams right near the Earth, carrying billions of alien souls, and we are too stupid to even know it. How would we even know it with our primitive instruments? Think about that. The galaxy could be teeming with life forms, and here we are scratching our heads wondering, is there any life in outer space?
Right. We're limited by our ideas, our preconceived ideas of what alien life forms would look like.
Right. We think they're going to use radio to communicate.
Right.
We think they're going to have clunky flying saucers. I mean, give me a break.
We're completely out of time. And trust me, listeners, we've only barely scratched the surface of what's covered in this book. So much is covered in this book. It's like you're sort of exhausted by the time of it. It is amazing. My guest tonight is Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, one of the co-founders of string theory and a great writer of science. And we've been talking about his latest book, The Future of Humanity, Terraforming Mars, Interstellar Travel, Immortality, and Our Destiny Beyond Earth. I just want it to all happen now. I want to be part of it. Thank you so much for your time, Professor.
My pleasure.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.